As soon as they left the synagogue, they entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they told him about her at once. He came and took her by the hand and lifted her up. Then the fever left her, and she began to serve them. That evening, at sundown, they brought to him all who were sick or possessed with demons, and the whole city was gathered around the door. And he cured many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he would not permit the demons to speak because they knew him. In the morning, while it was still very dark, he got up and went out to a deserted place, and there he prayed. And Simon and his companions hunted for him. When they found him, they said to him, "Everyone is searching for you." He answered, "Let us go on to the neighboring towns, so that I may proclaim the message there also, for that is what I came out to do." And he went throughout Galilee, proclaiming the message in their synagogues and casting out demons. The Gospel of the Lord. You have heard it said that you should love your neighbors and hate your enemies. But I say to you, you should love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. The words of our Lord Jesus Christ, who goes on to say that his Father God makes the sun to shine on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the just and the unjust alike. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? God is Lord of the just and the unjust. Put it in more local language, God is the Lord of the law-abiding citizen, and God is Lord of the person who is in prison. God is Lord of all. Dietrich Bonhoeffer writes that just as our love for God begins by listening to God's word, the beginning of our love for others is to learn to listen to them. And we believe in a God who listens. We hear of a God who listens in the Old Testament when the people under the bondage of slavery cry out to the Lord for help. And what do we hear? God hears their cry, and God sends someone to deliver them. We hear throughout the Gospels as Jesus travels about his earthly ministry that those who are in need, those who are in need of healing, call out to him, and Jesus hears them, and he offers them the gift of healing. We believe in a God who listens, which is why Bonhoeffer says we do God's work for our brothers and sisters when we learn to listen to them. It is that type of listening that is at the heart of our vision for this congregation to put into place an academy for creative endeavor, the capacity for us as a congregation to engage significant issues in the life of our community in a way that is not divisive. Believing that we too often go to our political system to solve our problems, when many times the best thing they can do is offer us a functional solution that has the support of the majority of people that may or may not be a moral decision. We have engaged that type of academy connected with the topic of the 3 suicide deaths at the Lancaster County Prison last year within a 6-month time period. And we have taken time as a congregation to listen to what people have been saying about that circumstance. I've had people who have approached me and said, "Pastor, I don't think this is the church's business." Pastor, there are places where these problems can be handled. It is the church's responsibility to deal with the spiritual lives of the people within our own congregation. The person went on to say, "Lord knows most of them need it." He was convinced he, however, did not need that kind of spiritual help. Pastor, thank you for taking time to let us talk about this issue. Pastor, it is about time that the church uses its voice to speak about that issue in the community. Which one of those perceptions is right? I think they all are, but not by themselves. And we can get closer to discovering that kernel of truth if we allow room for all of those perspectives to coexist at the same time. It is possible for those perspectives to coexist at the same time if we have a respect for the integrity of other people. Respect to take a second look, from the original word that gives us spectacle and spectator, to look at, the prefix re, to do it again, to give people a second look. Integrity, the sense that I know where I stop and you start, that somehow we don't morph into each other, but I know where I stop and you start. To respect the integrity of another person is to give a person another look and understand where you stop and the other person begins. It's important to have that respect for integrity, because if we don't respect integrity, we violate one another. It can happen physically when one person imposes himself upon another person. It could happen in violent ways as people bring about violent actions against the body, the physical presence of another person. It can happen through the power of words, that we cut that person down with the power of our words. It can happen by taking what belongs to someone that they need for their daily sustenance and taking it for themselves. It is a violation of the integrity of the other person. It is what at the core of we call a crime. Crime is violating the integrity of another person. We have in our nation put laws into effect to deal with some of those crimes. Some of those laws come into being because they have been commonly held by our culture. It makes sense that we establish them in written form. But there are other laws that come into being because it is our reaction to something that has happened or our fear of a risk that is in front of us. It is Daniel Kahneman in his book Thinking, Fast and Slow, who addresses that risk that we face. And from one perspective, he quotes the perspective of Paul Slavik, who makes a distinction between the way experts approach certain issues and the way most people approach certain issues. Experts weigh things by numbers, the number of deaths or the number of life years that are lost, he writes, and that as long as that number doesn't exceed what is normally held to be acceptable, then we are doing okay. Humanity, however, Slavik observes, puts a different value on human life and values life based upon whether it is good or bad. there's a sentiment behind the way that the normal person takes a look at human life. He wants us to weigh the importance of that public sentiment whenever life is lost or life years are taken away, and to give that more weight than the experts. On the other side of that conversation is Cass Sustine and Timur Kuran, who, when they talk about how we face risks, talk about this cycle that kicks into gear, that something happens that the media grabs hold of. And when the media grabs hold of it, it puts out there in front of us. And because it is putting it out in front of all people, there will be a segment of our population that will immediately be moved by it. Our hearts will break, our dander will get up, we'll get angry about something. And when that sentiment arises, the media covers that sentiment because it makes good copy. And so it continues to expand then, this emotional investment in what has happened, until the point where our political leaders feel the pressure to respond to that human sentiment, and many times they use resources that are available for other problems to address that sentiment, which may or may not be an issue worth addressing. And any person that dares to take the risk to say it is really not that important of an issue is accused of some kind of self-deception. Sustine and Kuran want us to hold on to the expert, the person who can make the rational decisions for those difficult issues. Daniel Kahneman says, let's hold the two together. Let's not pick one over and against the other. Let's allow them to live in tension with each other. That the public sentiment should be as much a part of the decision-making process as the perspective of the expert. It is holding those tensions together that allows us to move forward in the conversation. It has been the practice of Christians for generations in describing God to use opposites to describe God. God is the beginning and the end, the Alpha and the Omega. God is death and life. And to allow those opposites to exist in tension with each other, because how else do you express the unexpressible? You express it by holding opposites in perspective with each other. And so perhaps we can get at the ultimate if we allow the opposites to live in tension with each other. So as we speak to what has happened at our county prison, let's look at some of those tensions. It's the tension of humanity. How do you humanize another person? We had a wonderful moment last December as we gathered in our auditorium on a Wednesday night, where we allowed people to talk on their experiences of these deaths at the county prison. And what was unexpected but turned out to be a very rich moment for me is that family members of the three men who took their lives attended that forum. And what they did in that forum was to talk about the person, how that person was loved by family, how that person was treasured by those in the family, the role that that person played. We saw those people humanized in that event. And it was an important and powerful process for the family members, a needed way of coping with their pain. The other side of the humanizing process has been the need to hold up in front of us the crimes that these three men were accused of committing. of violating other people, and in some cases causing death. That is also part of the humanizing process. And there were those who needed to do that, because that kind of compartmentalization allowed them to cope with their own realities and their own feelings. How do you cope with someone who does something that takes the life of another person? To humanize is to acknowledge that in every person there is the capacity to do good and there is the capacity to do evil. It exists in every person. I still remember talking with a homicide detective in another city a few years back who had quite a good record of solving crimes. And in the conversation, he said, "You know, Pastor, I became good at my job whenever I was willing to admit that I had the capacity to take someone else's life." Within each and every one of us lies the capacity to do good and the capacity to do harm. We allow that to live in tension with each other. When we divide the two up, it leads us in different directions related to a person taking his life. If we label a person as all good, then what we do is, if that person takes his or her life, is we start identifying the external factors that put that person under pressure so they finally took their lives. But you notice what happens if we label a person evil or bad. We internalize the factors. The person felt guilty. The person was overwhelmed with shame. The person couldn't live with the reality of what he had done. And we internalize the causes. I think that our response would have been very different if it had been three high school students from one school district in 6 months who took their lives, instead of three criminals in the county prison. And we would be more concerned about what was happening in the school than in the prison. We are all fully human as a gift of the incarnation of Jesus Christ. And it allows us to acknowledge in our humanity that we can do good and we can do harm. That helps us give us a different definition of justice. In Christian writing and a lot of other classic literature, people are talked about as being wise or being foolish or even being evil. You know, the wise person, when he or she does something wrong and is confronted with what they have done wrong, sees the error of their ways, is willing to live with the consequences of their ways, is willing to make amends to turn it around. The foolish person, when confronted with that, resists being confronted with that reality, comes up with excuses on a regular basis. There's a necessity for limits and consequences for those who take that foolish approach. And there is indeed those few who could be classified as evil that passionately desire the destruction of other people. And our criminal justice system speaks to people who are wise, foolish, and evil, in that it holds people accountable for their actions. It has people reflect upon the consequences of those actions. But justice also requires us as a society to give people the opportunity to make it right. And I think that is where we continue to fail. to provide the resources that people need when they come out of prison to get back up on their feet. The obstacles to housing and jobs because of being an ex-offender are significant. The opportunity to make it right, knowing that there are some, because of the nature of who they are and their evil desires to harm others, I think should never leave a prison. Power is at play in the criminal justice system. Power is a reality in all of our lives. Those who enter the criminal justice system experience what it means to be powerless. I think very few of us truly understand what it means to be powerless to that level. We may have experienced brief moments of that in our lives, but we are not aware of what it is like to be powerless for an extended period of time. To not have a voice, or to have your voice diminished because you are who you are, or to be afraid to speak up, even with a legitimate concern for fear of retribution. I also don't want to underestimate the power of fear that people who are corrections officers and police officers face in their own daily lives. I really don't know what it is like to walk through a prison and know that at any moment my life is in jeopardy. That if that crowd of people around me so were moved, I wouldn't stand a chance. And that is the ongoing fear that corrections officers face. Still remember that moment years ago in my ministry in Columbus, Ohio, where every Friday night we would take kids from our neighborhood and take them to the YMCA for swimming and basketball. And a new kid came that night and he was riding in my car, and halfway to the YMCA, he pulled out a gun. The terror I felt at that moment. Short-lived for me. But it has kept me wondering what it feels like to live with that fear every day you go to work. We must also understand that wanting to be helpful to others is a position of power. That for many, being helpful to others is what completes their self-worth. And there is a need to be helpful in order to feel good about who you are. But being in a position of power is in part also being helpful. We must understand those dynamics of power to hear person after person from our county prison tell us that they did not receive the medical attention they required when they were in prison, but afraid to say anything for fear of the consequences of speaking that truth. I have heard of enough circumstances to believe there is a kernel of truth wrapped up in that need. We live in an age of high anxiety and worry. That feeling that we are just on the edge of falling into everything coming apart. it will only take one small thing for everything to come crashing down. And systems theorists really give us a wonderful perspective in how that process works, that this high level of anxiety leads, first of all, to reactivity. You know, what we as base animals and not human beings do, when the doctor hits your knee with the hammer, you kick the doctor. That's a reflex, a reaction. Too often when anxiety is high, we're acting in that own level of reactivity. This reactivity leads to what systems theories call herding. That is to come together with people who agree with you. That level of clumping, that misery loves company, to be surrounded by people who will agree with the way you feel and the way that you think. Coming out of that hurting then is this need to blame someone else. Because obviously you have the right ideology, it has to be the person who has the wrong ideology's fault. And in that blaming of other people, we see the need for the quick fix. If only they would do this, all the problems would go away. What is required in highly anxious times is a maturity among human beings. I think one of the ways that that maturity is challenged, and if we are taught to function at a lower level, is by the way that the media reports stories to us. That in the age of breaking news and the continuing news cycle, all we see is the problem. We don't have shown to us the steps that are being taken to resolve the problem, and most of the time there are steps being taken to resolve the problem. This morning, officers from the city police department are gathering together to do what is called an AAR, an after-action review of the incident down at Sneaker Villa when they thought there was a man armed with a gun threatening the lives of other people. There are processes in place that people use to make sure problems get solved. I would call for the media to add to their reports after they report what is happening is remind us of the processes that exist. To assure us that there are people working on these challenges. But when the anxiety level goes down, so does our need to buy products, and so does then supportership of the news broadcast. The other challenge with anxiety is that the institutions that help people mature are under attack by anxious people. And it is our schools that have the capacity to help people mature. But we have gone after them, making them the scapegoats for all of our problems, and have diminished what they can do for us to data and technique. We have extraordinarily gifted teachers and educators who are ready to help our children grow and mature. But that's not what we're asking from them. We're asking them to teach our kids to get a better paying job. Our schools can help us mature and to break the heightened anxiety in our culture. There has been a public call for the resignation of the warden at the Lancaster County Prison because of what has happened last year. That has never been where this congregation has stood. Now, I've had members of the media who have said to me, "Pastor, if Trinity ever makes that decision, that'll make good copy and we'll give you all the press you want." I would not presume to make a personal judgment on this particular warden because I don't live his reality as the warden of that prison. Just as I would not expect him to step into the position of pastor of this church and understand right away what it involves, I would not be able to do the same thing in the prison. However, I do understand leadership and the qualities of leadership that I think are significant. What I think is important for us to do is to identify the qualities of leadership that we are looking for from our warden and then ask the question, is he or whoever fills that position down the line demonstrating those qualities? Does a person in that position understand complexity? You know, we like complicated because you can make a decision between the right answer and the wrong answer and it makes it go away. Complexity is not like that because many times there are many good answers. There are also then a lot of bad answers, and we have to pick the least worst option that exists. It is an awareness that solving one problem then creates other problems. We experience that every winter here in our parish house. In order for Peter to be warm upstairs, Andrea downstairs has to live in a sauna. You correct one problem, and you then create other problems. And with Andrea, then the guy that makes a lot of hot air is also right next to her in the next room. A leader that understands complexity. To understand and deal with complexity requires creativity and imagination. I'm not talking about crayons and crafts here, but I'm talking about start asking new questions. The dilemma we continue to fall in our culture is we keep asking the same questions and we assume we will get different answers at some point. Let's start asking new questions. I think a leader that has clarity of purpose is an effective leader for our institution. Who understands the purpose of why that institution exists, who has the courage to remind us as citizens that we want to feel safe, we want criminals locked up, and that that prison exists so we can feel safe. But we don't want to see the ugliness of what happens in that prison. It is a leader who is proactive, anticipates what the problems are going to be, and acts before someone raises a concern, and decides when the concern is raised whether it should be responded to or not. It is a leader who knows when to stand up for the corrections officers in that prison, but also a leader who has the courage to know when there needs to be action taken. I would challenge our elected officials as they make decisions about the leadership of the organizations and institutions in our county that they establish the qualities they want from their leaders and then ask the question whether their leaders are demonstrating those qualities or not. Lancaster County is an extraordinary community, full of wisdom, full of compassion, full of maturity. And I think that we have the capacity to engage the difficult issues that face us, to find ways to change our culture that are not purely politically driven. And that begins by listening and respecting the integrity of other people. Amen.